Good morning. This is Jeff Blankfort welcoming you to the December 23rd end-of-the-year edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. This past November 20th, Jonathan Pollard was released from a federal prison in North Carolina, 30 years after being arrested outside the gates of the Israeli embassy, for whom he had been providing massive amounts of top-secret information while working for U.S. Naval Intelligence in Washington. The granting of parole to the Jewish-American spy, who was made an Israeli citizen in 1995, was the result of massive pressure on President Obama from major Jewish-American organizations and by an array of Israeli officials, beginning with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. For the most part, they either portrayed Pollard as a victim of the late Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger's vindictiveness, rationalizing Pollard's betrayal, minimizing its severity, or insisting that however wrong his spying for Israel might have been, Pollard's long sentence was unfair. Those arguing that Pollard's crimes didn't amount to as much as Weinberger had said didn't know what they were talking about. As investigative journalist Seymour Hersh pointed out, that while Pollard claimed he only supplied Israel with information vital to its security, the truth was otherwise. According to Hersh, Pollard passed on to his Israeli handlers critical components of American intelligence, including the National Security Agency's 10-volume manual on how the U.S. gathered its signal intelligence and the names of thousands of people who had cooperated with U.S. intelligence agencies. Pollard's arrest, conviction, and long incarceration was an anomaly in the strange history of U.S.-Israel relations, which has seen more than a few investigations into past Israeli transgressions papered over or dropped. The expert on that subject is Grant Smith, the executive director of IRMEP, the Institute for Research Middle East Policy, whom I have interviewed on Takes on the World on a number of occasions. At 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking again with Grant about what the media hasn't told us and told the public about Pollard's case. So stay tuned for that. With reference to Seymour Hersh on yesterday's Democracy Now!, the prize-winning journalist discussed his latest article in Monday's London Review of Books entitled Military to Military, U.S. Intelligence Sharing in the Syrian War. Hersh reveals that elements of the U.S. military and the Defense Intelligence Agency have been far more concerned about the chaos that would occur in Syria should the Assad regime collapse than has been President Obama, as they bypassed the president, sharing critical intelligence with both Russia and indirectly with the Syrian military. Hersh confirmed what was said by Gareth Porter on my last program about Turkey and Saudi Arabia, as well as the U.S., having provided weapons for all the anti-Assad forces, including ISIS. Many came from Muammar Gaddafi's stock of conventional weapons in Libya, which was quickly plundered after his murder. Hersh's article confirms rumors that what U.S. Ambassador Chris Stevens was doing when he was killed at that secret CIA compound in Benghazi was arranging shipments of these weapons to anti-government fighters in Syria. Speaking on Democracy Now!, Hersh also criticized Hillary Clinton's performance at Saturday night's Democratic candidates debate, noting that she had learned nothing from having been the administration's leading advocate for taking out Gaddafi. "I think there should be learning curves for people with that kind of power," Hersh said of Clinton. "I think that what happened in Libya should have instructed anybody in the government, including the president, that when you depose a dictator, you have to be aware of what's going to come next. You have to think long and hard about what you're doing. I think by any standard, getting rid of Gaddafi has proven to be a horrible event," said Hersh. "It was a terrible decision, and we seem not to have learned enough from it," end quote. Neither Hersh nor the American public had the dubious benefit of hearing Clinton's latest speech before the Saban Forum of the Brookings Institution on December 6th, which exposed her passionate attachment to Israel and to her Israeli-born benefactor, billionaire communications mogul Haim Saban. What she had to say about the future of Israel-U.S. relations would be rejected by the Democratic Party's base these days. That's according to polls and to an incident at the 2012 Democratic Convention, which saw the party's delegates three times shout down an attempt to insert a pro-Israel plank into the party platform after the platform committee had earlier rejected it. Despite the clear message of rejection coming from the floor, the convention's chair that evening, L.A. Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa, a favorite of that city's pro-Israel Jewish community, declared that it had passed. That vote and the torrent of boos that followed Villaraigosa's decision sent a warning to the Democratic National Committee that has long functioned as an unofficial arm of the Israel lobby. They have to find a way for the party to keep supporting Israel and attracting the wealthy Jewish funders who demand it without alienating the party's increasingly multi-hued base that is on a very different page. And that, dear listeners, is why the very critical issue of U.S.-Israel relations has not been mentioned at the candidates' debates thus far. Saban has already donated tens of millions to both Clintons and to their foundation and has promised to spend what is needed to put Hillary in the White House. As I mentioned before, he famously told a New Yorker interviewer a few years back that politically he's a one-issue man, and that issue is Israel. With that introduction, I think you'll be interested in hearing this 8-minute, 48-second segment of Clinton's latest love letter to Israel prepared from her one-hour talk. So here is Madam Clinton.
The second trend that makes a strengthened U.S.-Israeli relationship essential is Iran's increasingly aggressive regional ambitions. Tehran's fingerprints are on nearly every conflict across the Middle East. Iran supports bad actors from Syria to Lebanon to Yemen and beyond. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard and its proxies are attempting to establish a beachhead on the Golan from which to threaten Israel. In southern Lebanon, Hezbollah is amassing an arsenal of rockets and artillery. And the Ayatollahs continue to threaten Israel's destruction at every opportunity. We all agree that Iran can never be allowed to obtain a nuclear weapon. Now, as you know, I supported the nuclear agreement negotiated by the United States and other members of the Security Council plus Germany. Is it perfect? No. No agreement like that ever is. But I believe if it is aggressively implemented and enforced, this deal will help us prevent a nuclear-armed Iran. Now, that said, it's not enough to say yes to this deal. We have to say yes, and we will vigorously enforce it. Yes, and we will embed it in a larger effort to counter Iran across the region. How we handle enforcement in these early months will set the tone for years to come. So we have to get it right. Our message to Iran must be unequivocal. There will be consequences for even small violations, and we are ready to snap back sanctions into place. Our approach must be distrust and verify. There can be no doubt in Tehran that if we see any indication that Iran's leaders are violating their commitments in the deal not to seek, develop, or acquire any nuclear weapons, we will stop them. And we will make sure the Iranians and the world understand that the United States will act decisively if necessary, including taking military action. And we should also hold Iran and the Revolutionary Guard Corps accountable for their sponsorship of terrorism, ballistic missile development, human rights violations, detention of Americans, and other illicit behavior like cybercrime. Now, make no mistake, Iran will test our resolve. They've already started to do so with a ballistic missile test and other provocative behavior. We have to respond to these provocations, including with further sanction designations as necessary. The third trend is the growing effort around the world to isolate and delegitimize Israel. This is not a new challenge. As Secretary of State, I called out systemic, structural, anti-Israel bias at the UN and fought to block the one-sided Goldstone report. Particularly at a time when anti-Semitism is on the rise across the world, especially in Europe, We need to repudiate efforts to malign and undermine Israel and the Jewish people. The boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, known as BDS, is the latest in the battle. Demonizing Israeli scientists and intellectuals, even young students, comparing Israel to South African apartheid. Now, no nation is above criticism, but this is wrong, and it should stop immediately. Some proponents of BDS may hope that pressuring Israel will lead to peace. Well, that's wrong, too. No outside force is going to resolve the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. And at the same time, we should oppose any unilateral action at the United Nations. Now, I know that sometimes this process can start to feel like that famous definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. But circumstances do change. Today in the Middle East, Israel and its Arab neighbors find that many of their strategic interests are increasingly aligned. That creates room for greater coordination. Neither Israel nor its Arab neighbors want to see Iran increase its influence in the region or violent jihadists gain greater footholds. So we should encourage more intelligence sharing and security cooperation, like the quiet partnership between Israel and Egypt to stabilize the Sinai. We should reaffirm that the Gulf is a region of vital interest to America and commit to sustaining a robust military relationship with our partners there to defend against radical jihadism and Iranian aggression in any form. So if you add it all up, radical jihadism on the rise, Iran seeking to extend its reach, efforts to delegitimize Israel, we can see how crucial it is for the United States and Israel to stand together closer than ever. And we can see how Israel's search for security, stability, and peace goes hand in hand with the broader effort the United States must lead to secure and stabilize the Middle East. Now, as I've said, it's time. It's time to take our alliance to the next level. A centerpiece of that effort must be ensuring that Israel continues to maintain its qualitative military edge. The United States should help further bolster Israeli air defenses, including to cover Israel's north, and make it a top priority to develop better tunnel detection technology to prevent arms smuggling and kidnapping. And we need to ensure that a new 10-year defense memorandum of understanding sends a clear message to Israel's enemies that they will never prevail. But we all know that our common security commitments are about more than lists of weapons or dollars and cents. They are about understanding each other, acting together, being on the same page. So let's expand high-level U.S.-Israel strategic consultations. Bring our best minds together for deeper discussions about enforcing the nuclear deal, countering Iran's regional ambitions, and developing new defense technologies for the future. If Israel and the United States stand shoulder to shoulder and present a united front to the region and the world, I'm confident we can meet the threats and challenges we face today. So we are two nations woven together, lands built by immigrants and exiles, seeking to live and worship in freedom, given life by democratic principles and sustained by the service and sacrifice of generations of patriots. Yet even with all this history, with all our common interests and shared values, none of us can or should take our relationship for granted. With every passing year, we must tie the bonds tighter, reach out to the next generation to bring them with us, and do the hard, necessary work of friendship. And the future of our relationship depends on building new ties for a new time.
Hillary Clinton. pledging her love to Israel, the Saban Forum, in a speech she would not dare to give or even mention in one of these debates. Asked afterward by Chaim Saban what she'd do on her first day of office if elected, Clinton repeated what she had said to Jewish audiences earlier. She would call the Israeli prime minister and invite him to the White House during her first month in office. Clinton, of course, is not the only Israeli first in Washington. Last week, four members of the House, two New York Jewish Democrats, Elliot Engel and Nita Lowy, and two Republicans, Mike Royce and Peter Roskam, co-sponsored a resolution that would tell the European Union that Congress opposes the European Union's decision to specially label imports from Israel originating in the occupied West Bank, claiming it would, quote, undermine efforts to achieve and negotiate Israeli-Palestinian peace process, end quote, which is, of course, a joke, and they know it. What it would do, in effect, is undermine U.S. policy that holds the Jewish settlements in the West Bank to be illegal under international law, which is also a joke since the behavior of our last three presidents has rendered that position virtually meaningless. One thing you won't find members of Congress speaking about is the Treasury Department's blind eye when it comes to nonprofits that funnel billions of dollars to Israel's Jewish settlements. Now, three plaintiffs, Palestinian-American writer Susan Abulhawa, Egyptian-American Mohammed Abdelaziz, and Michael Severall, a Jewish American whose research contributions to nonprofits like Friends of the Israeli Defense Forces, about whose fundraising prowess I've reported on to you in the past, they're demanding the Treasury Department do its job. According to the complaint filed last Wednesday, Treasury, quote, claims that it takes very vigorous and active role in terms of monitoring the activities of, quote, entities that fund settlements in Israel-occupied Palestine. If it does so, the 72-page complaint states, quote, it missed $1 billion in total transfers to the settlements in 2015 and at least $60 million in tax-deductible contributions to the IDF in a single month, December 2014. Far from engaging in charitable activities, the complaint alleges that these nonprofits land theft, expulsion of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from their land, demolition of their homes, and attacks by armed Israeli settlers against Palestinian civilians. Since Treasury may be described as an Israeli-occupied territory, the odds they will be given standing and allowed to proceed, let alone get the case mentioned in the U.S. media, are slim.